Welcome to the Accelerating Operational Performance Podcast. I'm Greg Schenkel, President of Unique Training and Development and Frontline Leadership Systems. And our mission here, of course, is to help you on your professional journey in terms of accelerating some of the projects that you're working on and to accelerate your career progress. This episode is brought to you by the LEAP program, Leadership Excellence Application Program, which for anyone who does our Frontline Leadership course, it gives them 9 months or up to 9 months of access for sustainability and reinforcement training. So that's the LEAP program. Today, I'm excited to welcome our guest, Carrie Ann Versace. Carrie Ann and I have known each other for probably 12 to 15 years, I think, even though we probably haven't connected in several years. I was saying that the last time that I saw Carrie Ann was probably in a restaurant while I was doing work for the commuter rail system near Los Angeles. And we'd also done some work for the company that Carrie Ann works for, which is called Alstom. Now, Alstom bought Bombardier Transportation, and they run the biggest rail transit system in Toronto, and then some others, of course, throughout North America. So I'm excited for you to meet Carrie today. She is a leadership performance and process leader for Alstom, and she's a force of nature when it comes to people leadership. She's got this amazing ability that we're going to probe in the podcast to connect with people at all levels, having worked from the shop floor to the C-suite. She's passionate about creating positive change in organizations. She's worked in everything from rail to maintenance to trades to even healthcare, and seriously, the list goes on. So if you're looking for practical tips on building a stronger team culture, improving communication, or navigating change in your organization, you don't want to miss what Carrie Ann is going to share with us today. And I guarantee that you're going to walk away with some valuable takeaways. It was a privilege to work with Carrie at Bombardier Transportation, which is now owned by Alstom, and helping working with the frontline leaders. And again, it's been a while since we connected, so I'm really happy to reconnect with her today. Welcome to the podcast, Carrie.
Thank you. So happy to be here. After that introduction, I just can't wait to hear what I'm going to say.
Me too. I'm excited, just like you are. And of course, if anyone needs to reach out to Carrie, we'll have her email address at Alstom in the podcast notes. You can look her up on LinkedIn. And of course, if you need a rail system managed or other transportation needs, you can visit alstom.com. So Carrie Ann, I'm just interested. One thing I always found about you, and you knew that this was one of your superpowers, is just this ability that you have to connect with people on the front lines. And given that the rail industry is very male dominated, and you're working really at that frontline level with technicians and maintenance and operations people, what has been some of your secret? Why is it that you relate so well to people at the front line?
Well, I think that's something that just comes very natural to some of us, right? That we tend to be a bit inductive in what we want to get done in a company, realizing that, you know, you have to go where the work is actually being done, right? But it's an interesting thing when you think about a company. We talk about companies like they're a thing, you know, like the company wants something, or the company's accomplishing something, or this team needs something. But really, companies are just a group of people. Without that group of people and those individual people, the company doesn't really want or do or exist for anything, right? So I think I just gravitated toward that because it was more sustainable. Somebody very early in my time with Alstom said, do you touch a train for your job? And of course, I said no. And they said, if you don't touch a train for your job, then you work for somebody who does. And that really stuck with me. That if we actually want anything to work, we have to start where the work is actually happening, and we have to find out and kind of pace with those folks and get some alignment there. So maybe I enjoy it. I'm a people person. I gravitate toward where the work is, the action is. I'm curious. I identify heavily with our product and our sites and our cities. But I also think it's a really effective way to be, to start there when you're trying to ramp up performance or get better results.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. Every operational environment, when people are distant from it, they never really have as much success. And I'm glad you mentioned that corporations are all made up. This is my latest mantra, is that everything is all made up. But at its core, people are not made up. So they really like it when you have those interactions. Now, when you go back over your career journey, You know, at least unless you're just overconfident from the beginning, but I always think that's just enthusiasm, is when did you see the first glimmerings of success? Is there something that comes to mind that taught you that, yeah, maybe I'm onto something here?
Yes. Well, I always say that every little bossy girl should be told, instead of she's bossy, that she's a good leader. But I knew that I liked to lead things, and she's tall, put her in charge of something. And I think I knew that very early. But what I didn't realize in the beginning is that if you are a leader and a very natural leader, and you go out and you have this enthusiasm and this motivation, and you have a very genuine, I have almost a cheerleader side to me. I can kind of get really excited about things. And that's where you start with people is, we can do this, you can do this. And we motivate and we work very hard and we channel all of that motivational leadership side, is that we can leave people behind and we can make that success very dependent on us and our presence. And the first real success I had, and I remember, I'm old enough, Greg, now to have an early years era in my career. Is that possible? So
I
I'm
hear
like
you.
a,
That's what I am now too. Yeah.
it's like for the Swifties out there, this is my early years era I'm going to refer to. But in my early years, I had all this success and excitement about doing projects, and people would say, "Oh, Hurricane Carrie's coming, and it's so amazing." And I would leave a site, and I would feel very good about it, and I would make great relationships. But a lot of those programs, when we went back to the real life, when somebody's not there doing that for you, is we weren't able to sustain some of the things that we put into place with really practical things. So what I learned at that time, and when I started to see true success, is if I would return to a project, or a person would call me years later, and we had some sustainable behavioral change or sustainable implementation. And that came from learning this concept of pace and lead.
Yeah.
And pace and lead, I have gravitated toward. There are times to pace, to get to know people, to level set, to really find out, what are you doing right now? Why are you doing it that way? How has it worked for you? How is it not working for you? Before jumping ahead and giving them all these wonderful pieces of advice and new projects and new visualizations and new, lean interventions, is if we pace and then we lead. And most of us are very good at one or the other. We're good at pacing and getting to know people and supporting them and saying, where you are is good, and I want to learn about you and I want to listen. And some of us are better at leading. Hey, this is a best practice. We know this works. We've used it in other sites or at other locations, and we know it's going to work for you too, like a salesman. And
Yeah.
I always say, if you're frustrated in your implementation, ask yourself, am I leading and leaving people in the dust? Am I leading too far ahead? And is that, that horse that I'm training falling apart, falling behind because they don't think they can catch up? Or am I pacing too much? I'm not pushing us. I'm not challenging us. I'm listening too much. We're getting bogged down in kind of our victim mentality or can't move forward mentality. And if you're frustrated, you're probably staying in one of those too long. And thankfully, I figured that out very early. So I ask myself that question a lot.
No, great perspective, and I like that. I mean, pacing also, by its nature, involves empathy, it involves rapport,
Yes.
and then the
Yes.
leading is kind of like, hey, now that we have this relationship, can I challenge you a little bit on something?
Yes, perfect.
So I like that. Yeah, it's the back and forth of that. That's a great way of expressing it. Yeah, most of us have also had setbacks. I know I have in my journey. Did you have a setback that you learned something from? Although it sounds like that happened a little bit early on when you were more in the cheerleader mode, and then you'd come back and they just needed you to be the cheerleader, so you were indispensable. But is there something else that was
Yes.
instructive to you that you learned from in your journey?
I think setbacks are inevitable, particularly in our environment. Because when you're in an operational, get it done, lean environment, things are changing, resources are changing. And I think that a setback for me that ended up being, turned into a positive, and maybe that's my personality, is I really, really got to try to sugarcoat that, right? But is that we can get really caught up with what's my job and what's their job. I shouldn't have to lead safety, or I'm not in charge of quality. Leadership should be leading safety. Leadership should be leading quality. And we sort of end up in these empty classrooms and our own work not being done. And so when we're asked to pivot from something we really believe in, that can be very difficult. And so if we don't have that ability to be agile and to support people to get them into the classroom to go and ask questions like, hey, we're at 62% training compliance. Why do you think that is? And to
So it's
do
about
that, yeah,
putting
it
the
was.
accountability back on the person. So
Yes.
the learning was, I guess, from that is just when you saw things falling down, it was usually because the ownership of it wasn't transferred to the right person.
Well, both sides. I think that ownership wasn't transferred, but also we tend to start right fighting when we're support functions or we're indirect to the service. So our quality folks, our business excellence folks, our safety folks, is that even leadership can sort of get in this mentality, well, I invited them, I reminded them, I told them they didn't do it, sorry. And sometimes I think that if you're going out and forming those relationships and creating a partnership to find out why that's happening, it's not handholding, it's not over supporting. I think it's okay to take on a support role and to help make it easier for people. I've coached some leaders that have gone for 2 or 3 or 4 years with, horrible results in the work that they care about. And they say, well, I've done everything I can do. I've done everything I can do. And it's their responsibility now to bring that, to make that happen. If they don't care about it, I can't care about it. And I just try to remind folks that if we see ourselves in service of the people that need to be in that classroom or that need to implement that process, if we see ourselves being able to balance giving them the ownership, but also forming that relationship where we ask them how to help them, I think that's a good mix, and definitely one that I learned through a lot of trial and error and early on with empty classrooms, wondering how much I should be doing for people versus how many empty classrooms I wanted to have.
No, that's a good point. Now, I mean, because, and I mispronounced the name, I probably I'm not the only one who calls it Alstom. It's really
Oh
Alstom.
yes,
Thank you for correcting me
Alstom.
on that. Yeah,
Yes,
Alstom.
wonderful.
And French company, but
Yes.
even going back to the Bombardier days, like we said, it tends to be very male dominated, and you have been recognized for your work in helping women be more successful in those organizations. So, including with Bombardier Transportation, then when Alstom bought it. So, we have this image, I think, of what a more macho rail type worker would be like, but you've been a coach and a confidant to them, and I'm not asking you to breach any of those things. I'm just wondering, what do people need to understand about these essentially very tough exterior folks that you got to see glimmers of behind the scenes as you built that nice coaching relationship? Are there, I'm just wondering how we enlighten people that
Yes.
say that just because people look tough on the outside does not mean that they're always tough throughout, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're all different and we all have, I mean, we have 30, just in North America, we have something like 30 sites just in my division of services. I mean, we build trains, we build systems for trains, we operate trains, we maintain trains. And it's a very different cultural environment for us, even just within North America, and Alstom is worldwide and everywhere. But even just in North America, there's large cultural shifts. Right, there's gender differences, there's age and generational differences. So the way that I tend to approach that, working with people that we kind of see as rough and tumble, and one of the reasons early in my career I became pretty famous for the tough room and the master of the tough room and working in these rough and tumble environments is that for me it's all about intent and impact. Oftentimes their intent is, even though they're coming across very aggressive, they're coming across in a way that maybe another person doesn't foresee, is their intent is actually usually very positive. I want my team to know that I'm in charge and that I can help. I want them to feel secure. I want them to know I've got their back. I want them to be safe. I want them to go home at night the same condition or better than they came in. I want them to follow this process or do this work so that people will, so they can win. I mean, winning's nice. I want my team to feel like they can win. But when you ask them what their impact is, it often doesn't match that intent. And that's where I start with people, no matter how rough the exterior or maybe even weak or non-commanding somebody may seem, is what's your intent? And what's your impact? And do you know what your impact is? And do they match? And
How do you line them up?
coaches get to live in this precious space. You know this, Greg, you live in this space. We get the honor of living in this precious space between somebody's intent and what their actual impact is, and trying to make those match. And I take that approach with everybody, regardless of their exterior.
Yeah, no, I think it, first of all, one of the reasons I like doing the podcast, besides getting to talk to great people like you, is I learned something, and I love that idea of alignment between intent and impact. It's a great way of crystallizing it. When you've seen your share of operational efficiency processes, schemes, flavor of the month, and I'm wondering when you have seen the ones that have gotten good traction and ones that have kind of slipped by the wayside, what observations would you make about all those ways that we have to try to make operations more efficient and productive?
You know what? We have as organizations so many examples of how to make something work better, be more efficient, be more safe. Our continuous improvement, our business excellence teams, we have all of these kind of templates and best practice and world-class examples. And sometimes I think we want to take this shiny thing and we want to implement it and just share it. And we know that it works. We've seen it work somewhere. We've seen it work elsewhere, or we've seen it work. So we bring it in and we want to just put in this shiny thing. And when we do that, we're really skipping an entire phase of change management, right? So what I always think is that don't build what you want to build when you're going in to implement something. Build what they need. Ask what their problems are. Some of that pacing and leading, but really level setting with what are you doing now? I mean, I've seen some really talented continuous improvement. I'm telling you, Alstom has some business excellence professionals that are top of their craft, right? And when they've done good work and when we've done good work, it's come from a few things. One is going in and respecting and honoring the history that's already there. Whether a site has been using a napkin to keep track of something, we find out what are you doing now? Wow, look what you did in these, you know, with the tools that you had. What problems are you having with it? What worked? And people aren't afraid of change, they're afraid of loss. So it's important to ask them, what is it we're afraid of losing by changing our visualization to do this, or changing our KPIs to do this, or changing our methodology, or even doing a study to see how this could be better? So just by coming in and doing that level set, I think that's the first thing that we need to do is solve their problems. Don't build a solution, but actually find out how you can match their problem. And so that would be one of them. The second thing is that we're getting very good in our business at bringing our teams in as multifunctional teams to implement a project. So we don't send Carrie in to do leadership coaching, just leadership coaching with somebody on the floor, and send our business excellence team in to do maybe an implementation of a system or a process. Is we try to create teams that go in and approach those things from all levels. So we're out there with you in your day-to-day job, implementing maybe a new visualization board, and then Carrie's talking to you about how you deliver that in your start of shift meeting, and our leaders are there, and we're all doing that in sort of this immersive way. And those have been the projects, I think, that sustain. Because if you build it and you leave, you're going to be spending all of your time, you know, having them duplicate and have, you know, double systems because they're still doing it their old way. You're going to have to retrain. You're not going to get compliance.
Yeah, so you have a nice way of describing it. I think that's so accessible. I think we get so excited about the potential for our project, we forget that the people will rebel against even the best sounding project if they can't see how it makes their lives easier, which goes back to being a servant leader. And you're just trying to make everybody's jobs a little bit easier, get better results with a little less stress and effort. So that's really great. Now, by the way, we're talking with Carrie Ann Versace, who's, I call her the leadership whisperer in these areas, because I saw her work magic both up and down and sideways in the organization in a way that she can confront people's reality, but in a supportive way. So I do want to switch a little bit to leadership development. Now, that's where we got to collaborate together, is you trusted us to do some of our frontline leadership training. And then you were there to supplement the coaching on the shop floor. So you have a very unique perspective because you've done your share of workshops and you've certainly done your share of supporting people who are going through other workshops. And I'm just wondering, what insights do you have around leadership development, growing better leaders over time? What made sort of better programs better? And the not so great ones didn't have the impact. I'm just curious what your insights are around just leadership development.
Oh, and isn't that the magic question in our space, right? Because it's not, I've seen a lot of great leadership videos and I've read a lot of great books, and I'm sure you have too. And they have these videos of people standing by a cubicle and they're giving feedback to each other. And the boss says, "Excuse me, Juan, could I see you in my office?" And they walk to an office. And that's not obviously the environment that we work in. So if we're showing them a leadership book or a leadership resource that's very general and we don't actually understand, they automatically know you don't get what I'm working in. You don't know that I'm yelling over a locomotive, standing next to a consist of 12 cars giving feedback, or that I have to find a corner in some part, to talk to someone. So I think the reason we were attracted, and I specifically was attracted to your program, was that you do have resources and examples that come from manufacturing, production, what I like to call our rough and tumble, environments, is that they see their work. They see how they could do it in their work where they work. So that's one, is it just has to be really
Relevant.
practical,
It's really around
relevant.
relevancy in that
Yes.
case, right?
Yes.
So they don't discard it. One of the things we have in the training business is the so-called happy sheet, which is the course evaluation, which says, how good was the course, how relevant was it, how knowledgeable was the instructor. And we almost belittle it because it's like, yeah, just because the happy sheet was good, it doesn't mean the course had any impact. But it is a hurdle to get over. So, you were instrumental in. And I can remember the early days when you would get just a couple of people who were willing to dip their toes in it just from your enthusiasm, and then let them come back and tell the others, yeah, the course was pretty good, it was relatable and relevant, and then you let the word of mouth sort of take it from there a bit. But when you, because you're still in the same sort of business, so first hurdle, relevancy. I'm just wondering the because a lot of our clients don't. I don't think do as good a job on coaching. And we recently had a project in the steel industry where we added coaching time to the project, and it really generated a much bigger impact. But I'm just wondering, how do you see the coaching with the formal training creating this like chemistry for success?
Yeah, it's so integral. And if you can have a coach, now maybe I'm biased, because Alston picked me up at Bombardier back in the day, and I'm an in-house coach and I can be responsive to our current issues. I understand the situations they're in. We've gone through some major things in the past few years. Our company had a huge integration. We had the pandemic happened around that time. People are going through a lot of stuff. So if you have somebody that has relationships that's there, that's not just a consultant or coming in or visiting, and they really learn the language of the organization and the realities, like that's a really good connection piece. But that tacks on to relevance. If we think about the next piece I would add to relevance, is that it has to be actionable. You have to take whatever they're learning and create actions, follow up, practice that they can actually go out and do that isn't going to feel artificial, something they can do in their organic environment. And that coaching piece for us, there's lots of different kinds of coaching. I do some virtual coaching in our organization, but there's nothing like having a coach that has literally had boots on, has walked the floor with you, that understands your work environment. So that piece is strong if you're able to have that. And if you're not, you hire somebody like you who comes in, who does a tour, who looks around. I mean, I've asked leadership folks, what their discovery process is, and they don't have one. You tell them what you want them to know. Whereas if you get somebody who really wants a long-term relationship with your business, they're going to come have a look-see. They're going to ask you where you're located. They're going to find out what's the term you use for your start a shift meeting. Nothing will disconnect somebody who's a very practical frontline worker than if you use a term that they know. Oh, okay. Even in our business, we vary in what we say for start of shift or a safety brief or a 5-minute meeting. So just learning that vernacular. So relevance, and also somebody who has that connection as a coach in your real environment, if you can create that, is incredible.
Well, and I think the fact that, I mean, the realities today, especially when you're servicing as many sites as you're helping, you will do the site visit. That builds the credibility. Then you can use the virtual to sort of take care of things efficiently.
Yes.
Now, one of the areas you've been again, especially recognized in and probably very, it's a sense of pride, is this idea of diversity. Now, I know these days when we're recording this, you know, DEI and things have become sort of an, I'm going to say negative, and a lot of companies are backtracking. So I'm not going to debate that. I'm just going to say that there were good reasons to help workforces become, allow more voices to be heard and become more attractive to more people, so that they wouldn't have a talent shortage and they'd get the benefit of the ideas. But I'm just wondering, what are you saying these days, knowing that you've been a champion in this area? How do you kind of deal with this in a very practical way that doesn't sort of raise political red flags?
No, it's, you know what it is that when you think about the terminology and people grasping to grab onto terms, you know, when you're hurting or you feel disadvantaged, you want to find a term, you want to find something that captures why maybe that's happening to you. And so, you know, sadly, we've grabbed on to that diversity and equity and inclusion, or DEI, as a concept. And people tend to think about quotas, and they tend to think about hiring quotas and hiring targets. And but when I talk about inclusion, I'm literally talking about the diversity of ideas and approaches that are on a team, and the ability to include all the folks that you have there, so that you're able to have this group that can think together and work together, coming from all of their disparate places. There's lots of business reasons why we should have diverse people working in, you know, it's not sustainable to have a non-diverse team in an organization. So we focus on the practical stuff. We ask people, you know, who are you mentoring as your, for your succession plan? And are they all like you? Are they all in your age group? Are they all your same gender? Are they all your same ethnic background or your language? Do they all come from the same college or university or trade school or apprenticeship or company? And if you, the first thing you can do is ask yourself, am I doing the same things with people who are not like me? And that has nothing to do with the political ramifications or quotas that we talk about. That has to do with you looking at how you're including and being equal with the people that you work with from any background, really. So we're still doing that work. Alstom is still very much a diversity organization and committed to our DEI. And we can be very proud of that. I think it's a good reason to work for Alstom, is that they balance that well. But even when we're not using it in the political context, we're just focusing on how we treat each other. And that's culture, right? That's your culture. So I think
you're taking the practical side of it too, which is, it's the right thing to do. It's a good thing to do, and you benefit from doing it. So it doesn't have to have the, I just love the way that you said it. It's really just your culture, how you treat people, and how you get the benefit of having a culture that allows people to feel included. Now, one of the things that is vexing a lot of folks, although I noticed that over time this becomes a little less of a hot button, multi-generational motivation, dealing with younger and older and more seasoned and newer folks. And the reason I think it's actually slightly waning is because there was a time when all the leadership jobs were all clogged up with people probably in their 50s and 60s. Yeah. And now finally, no retirements and demographics. So there's a lot more younger folks. So I don't actually think it's going to be as big a deal as time goes by, because it just becomes normal like any other change. But I'm wondering, what advice have you given to people who might be struggling with, you know, the work ethic of younger or newer employees versus more seasoned? And, you know, you work in an industry that has, I don't know, hundreds of years of, you know, background, and I'm telling you, back in my day, blah, blah, blah. So what advice do you give around multiple generations and creating that environment?
You know, I think it's important for us from an academic sort of way to learn and know and take the time just to figure out that different generations take in information differently. They prefer to share information or communicate differently. And if we just know that, even if we don't agree or align with how they do it, if we can just understand why this guy is always calling me on the phone when he could text me, or why am I still studying from a textbook manual when I could be getting this on my phone in an app, if we just understand that part academically, then we've done some of the work. But I think from a way that we engage with each other, it's about understanding that if we don't have generational challenges, if we don't have friction between our generations, we're not working very hard. Because you do come from a generation. We all
Yeah.
come from different very you we all have stereotypes that are true about our generation, and they all have positives. So when we have safety critical environments, there is a great benefit to having that boss that says, you will do this, you will, I will direct this, this will not be deviated from. I have earned my keep by keeping people safe and my crew for the last 40 years. You know, there's a benefit to that rigidity in that environment. There's also a benefit to somebody saying, hey, I'm 20 something years old, this is my first job, but I have all these ideas that you haven't thought of yet. So there's a positive to some of those things that create friction. It's about healthy friction. And I describe healthy friction as friction moves us forward, right? Like I'm in the rail business. We don't move anywhere without friction. But if it's healthy, it means we're seeing and valuing and respecting that somebody comes from another place. It doesn't have to mean that that's your value. I may always value my work ethic that's a little different when it comes to compartmentalizing and work is work and home is home. But I can see the value in some of the newer generation feeling that they want to be their whole self at work. They want to be the same person. They want to make their work and their life balance better. So if you look for positive intent and you look for something that's good about that and you can align on that, then I think it helps that friction be more healthy. And there'll always be that friction. It's natural.
I love, I mean, that ties into something that we teach in conflict. It's just conflict is not something to be avoided. And what I really didn't think of, which is great, is that the fact that there's a disagreement and that creates energy, that friction creates energy and some heat, it allows you to actually say, maybe there is a slightly better way. Because if we all said, I'm telling you right now, the old way is the only way, you wouldn't have any innovation and growth and development. So you only have through the friction of old and new ideas any kind of progress. And that doesn't mean every new idea is great. Doesn't mean all the old ideas are great, but the friction
No.
between them allows you to figure out what's great and use that.
Yes, and think about how what a superpower it is if you're a leader and you have four generations on your team and you pick up the very best from all of those generations and how they approach information or learning or how they share ideas and how they give feedback. If we went looking for what's right with people instead of looking for what's wrong with people, I think that would help us, you know, to see, but we tend to be, again, we don't fear change, we fear loss. And if somebody from a new generation or a different generation does things a different way, I may fear that I don't have the same chances or opportunities, or I'm not going to be
Because
viewed
I don't
fairly.
understand it, right? I don't understand
Absolutely.
it, and therefore I'm scared of it. So a lot of things, the boogie monster of the unknown really throws us all off, I think. So first of all, we're talking with Carrie Ann Versace, who is an internal leadership coach and advisor within Alstom, which is a very large French-owned transportation company, formerly Bombardier Transportation. So you probably don't even necessarily know the company, but you've probably been on one of its airport trains going from a terminal to the parking lot, or riding a commuter rail system, which they manage as a third party. So Carrie Ann, I'd just always like to give this last option. If there's something else that you wanted to share that I didn't ask you about, what other message would you love to deliver before we wrap up?
Oh, GC, you never give Carrie Versace this opportunity. I warned you about Hurricane Carrie. Okay, but well, I think I spend a lot. I talked about intent versus impact, and that's one that I love. But it goes with a couple of other things that I talk about. And one is that I coach a lot with folks that are looking to move up in their career, and they use this term up. We tend to use this up because we want to advance. And what I say to people about advancement is that if we think about it, and I love me a good metaphor, Greg, is if we think about it like a plant or a tree and it's growing up and we plant it and we want it to get vertical, we want it to grow. But if it grows too fast and it grows without the right kind of environment, we end up with gaps, it's leggy, you know, we can see through it, it's not really solid. So I always tell people, you know, yes, you can focus on growing up in your career, but don't forget about filling in and growing in your career. Get to know everybody that interfaces with your position. If you're a manager of production, go and meet your quality people. Find out exactly what they do. Ask what you do that makes their life miserable. Ask what your team does that makes their life great. Talk to your safety people. Talk to your, because one, you may find a different trajectory for your career, a different specialty. And even if not, your next level won't be judged by how good you are at your current job, how good you are at getting your team to do things. Your next level will most likely be judged at your impact on other people and how you work with your peers and the other functions. Do people want to work with you? Are you going to elevate others? We don't want to hire superstars so much as we get into leadership, because if you're a superstar, but your impact on others is negative and you're depleting them, then you're a net loss on that team. So we want people who are able to do that. So just think about in your career growing kind of out and filling in as much as you want to advance. And of course, we know that's very natural. And the last thing that I spend a lot of my time talking about is that oftentimes we see kind of our type of training or people stuff as the fluffy stuff, right? Like that's the fluffy stuff, and Carrie can come in and do her show and that'll be great and people will be happy for a moment and then we leave. But what I really see it as is that the best organizations learn the balance between people and results. I think about it like driving a standard transmission, if anybody can still do that anymore. But, you know, we have to put on the gas. You have to drive results, especially in our business. We don't have time to sit around and talk about problems all day. We've got to actually get something to happen. And there'll be times I just need to count on you to comply and do things. And we have to hammer those results. We have to put on that gas. But as you know, with driving that car, if you have that clutch pushed in and you're revving on that gas, you're going nowhere. The people side is where we focus on balancing, meeting with the people where they are, talking with the people, using these skills to actually solve the problems for them in partnership with them. And if we always think about being frustrated, if we're too much on the people side, we never get anywhere. We're not challenging. We're not winning, right? No one ever says my favorite boss was the easy one that didn't make me work and I just sat around all day, right? We choose the fair, challenging boss that knew how to balance people and
helped us win and achieve. Yeah.
Yeah. So that balance is where I spend my life. So I think if people do that when they go into their projects, along with some of that other kind of people activating stuff, that's sort of the magic dust that only time I've seen quantum leaps in production or that low hanging fruit we talk about is really when people balance the results and the people, and they bring their teams in to do that encompassing with the people side of the project.
I see you talking with your hands a little bit. One thing that, because we're in the leadership training business, and I think the day will eventually come where the soft skills topics and then this lean and operational excellence side, I don't think people really actually learn particularly well in topics because they're thinking about interactions, which is that practical piece. I think the eventual solution will be this integration. Now we're calling it OPAL, which is operational performance and leadership, because we really think they need to be mashed together a little bit more. Okay. I will say it's tough because the train is rolling down the tracks. Sorry, I had to mention that. But it's like we're in this momentum where we're just so used to workshops and topics. And really, we should be thinking about what interactions people are having that are driving the business results and how to improve those interactions. And I think that's where you come in. So I really wanted to say thank you for taking the time. I remember now all the good reasons why I loved collaborating with you, because you're super smart, but you have a big heart. And I think the heart and the smart go together very well. So again, if you need to reach Carrie, you can find her email address at Alstom in our notes here. And of course, you can look her up on LinkedIn, Carrie Ann Versace. So Carrie Ann, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Absolutely a pleasure, as always.
Remember that if you need any help in your team navigating how the soft skills drive the operating results, we should be one of the resources that you talk to for all the reasons that Carrie mentioned, our relevancy and our fact that we're always investigating, is there a better way of doing this? And you can start a conversation with us on our website at uniquedevelopment.com. So for now, I'd simply wish you well on your leadership journey.